Hello, this is Cameron McEwen and Bob Dobbs with episode 77, and we're on page 162 at the bottom with the Croker quote. That's where we left off, and of my book slash pamphlet. And we're getting into it right away. We're starting a little late, so Cameron wants to refer to the page 11 of Take Today, that quote. So take it away.
Yeah, I just, on 160 at the head of this chapter, you quote McLuhan and Barry from Take Today, page 11. It is man who has become both figure and ground via the electrotechnical extension of his awareness. I just want to point out that at least since Plato, so 2,500 years ago, the problem of trying to talk about human awareness is that any kind of talk, any kind of writing directed to that problem, of course, is itself human awareness. And up until the present time, no one has figured out how to get out of that magic circle. And I just want to suggest that everything in this chapter and in the Tech Body chapter to follow, one of the contexts that we need to understand this stuff within is this circle that is imprisoning human awareness, that doesn't allow it to get out of itself to understand the problems that it itself is continually bringing into the world.
Is that the cliche that our minds screw with us?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Or it's the rear view mirror problem.
It's, yeah, but no, that's a metaphor. We don't know what the mind is. We don't know what our self-consciousness is. And they always say the animals don't have the self-consciousness. This is the bane of being human. We've got this self-awareness, and we don't know what it is or how to resolve it. Some people call that the mind, right? We get a mind,
yes,
and nature doesn't. So it has changed. That's the man as continues to be content on page 11. Still the content, maybe, right? After the quote, it says, man is still the content. The content is lost in our mirror of ourselves or the mind. We can't resolve the split. Now, I remember Croker talking about the antinomies of Hellenic culture, you know, 2,000 more years ago. They
yep.
couldn't stop. They couldn't get out of the classical paradoxes, which became apparent through the alphabet and the beginning of visual space. But he says that Augustine solved the problem. I think this is Talcott Parsons or Cochrane, one of those guys said this. And he knew about that, so he's quoting it. He says, Augustine created the third term to resolve the classical dialectic antinomies, I think was the word. And so that third term was a novelty because that was the abstraction that the alphabet created, or the schizoidness. So it doubled the self-awareness double problem, which was always there. It added another dimension to it, and Augustine thought he solved it.
Yes. A lot of people thought they solved it, and it's nearly always has to do with some third term.
Yeah.
The problem is that although individual people flatter themselves along those lines, obtaining any sort of practical application of that thought remains outstanding. And it remains outstanding at a time when mind is incredibly misused and represents a tremendous danger to itself.
And that would be the effect of the printing press, right?
Yeah, well, it's you could say it's the effect of the printing press, but the printing press only magnifies what is already in humans.
Yeah, but it doubled it. It went further than the alphabet. As a matter of fact, it made people think they were into the third term of expanding, and they were having the excitement of the novelty of writing and publishing and coming up with ideas and debating it
and
all.
The same thing is happening now, but instead of being squared, it's being cubed. McLuhan came to see that the electrical awareness didn't necessarily solve the problem of the Gutenberg galaxy in the printing press. It could actually make those problems worse.
Right, and the cube, that's on my chart in the Dobbs quadrant. I don't know if you've noticed that, the cube level. I think quadrophenia cubed, something like that.
Well, so you're right.
That's in there. So the electric environment, because in my quadrant, which is the whole chart, and then I have the different sub-quadrants, but 60 to 90 is this growing of the Android meme, and I call it ecstasy. There's something about the electric environment that people think they can dispense with the printed delusion or the printed disservice, and then they're stoned electrically. And they're not taking drugs necessarily, though the culture does get on drugs as therapy, but it can be constantly engaged in receiving percept, new data. I remember McLuhan saying, some famous poet of 200 or 300 years ago, he loved watching images, whatever images was just starting to come in England or someplace. So he's saying, look, it's, you know, people are, that's the poetic drive, to engage in sensory overload or sensory perception and enhance it with whatever gadget humans come up with. So what is that doing to the doubleness of self-awareness? It's allowing us to diminish it a bit. But because we are literate and never solved it, it catches up on people at some point. It screws them up, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm agreeing with you. This is a problem that lies at the heart of being human. Humans constantly have the possibility of liberation, but they don't want to be liberated. And one of the factors that keeps them from being liberated is that they have completely stoned ideas of what it would be to be liberated.
Yeah. They imagine they can totally slough off the mind and function somehow, or the thinking about things, or the awareness of things, they can get to this stone thing. I mean, the Extropians think they can do that by extracting the brain or something and put it into a computer matrix, right? And somehow you've solved a lot of the self-awareness problems. But the in the 50s with the beatniks and the beginning of the counterculture, people start saying the Cartesian mind's a problem, and they call it the mind-body problem. And Alan Watts would talk a lot about that and became famous. They would not talk about the technical effects like McLuhan did. He said Watts was too simple. But they somehow thought they were going to get liberated. So there's lots of visions of being liberated from the mind self-awareness and unconscious literate effect. But then that led to, you know, excessive Buddhism, meditation, Zen monasteries, and drug taking, and then the culture getting more crazy in the 70s, and it just became normal. Businessmen were doing cocaine. The drive to get yourself out of the self-awareness became more and more intense. Or would you say it was always like that in humans?
I think you're right that the drive became more and more intense. But when a drive becomes more and more intense, instead of tending to solution, that drive can turn to deeper problems, can turn into deeper problems. And so that's, it's not only a problem of mind becoming aware of mind, it's also a problem that the very drive to that end is itself distorted.
Yeah, all the notions of liberation, what Baudrillard called all the different, he called it after the orgy. So all these different sensory explosions and exaggerations and communal disruption or communal exaggeration, none of it worked for some level. And so they've been saying that our world has been malaised and depressed the last 10, 15, 20 years, right? Because nothing, nobody's got an answer verbally about anything. And we're just going on a collision course, which is what you see. We just can't stop it. Because nobody has a way to articulate something that'll make people stop. So in that sense, we're out of our mind, and then that means we're into virtual space, and then we get into the digital subjectivity and people thinking, just texting and involved in their virtual computers all day long. That's the new drug. It's not a chemical body drug. It's a life drug based on the technology and how far it's extended. So we really got ourselves in a mess here, you know, that's which is biblically kind of predicted, maybe by all the prophets, right? We were going to do ourselves in. And it got distorted by different levels of religious belief and different ways of people worrying about it and praying or trying to get themselves out of it. But the seriousness of the problem, I think, that was the prophets were pointing to. And McLuhan started to see that. He saw, this is a bad problem we got here, you know. We can't even have religion anymore, he said.
Yeah, well, he was, very early on, he was aware that most religion was part of the problem.
Yeah, and religion was, like he said, sin was really awareness, not anything else the culture said. It was the awareness problem, he said, was original sin, which I guess you're citing, the awareness problem.
Yes, but the problem I see to that is that people use the word awareness, or even we're using the word awareness now, but we don't know what that means. We don't know what awareness is in the sense of we're not able to pass on to people who need that awareness. We're not able to pass that awareness on.
Because more and more people are saying everybody's getting stupider. I don't think the Native Americans or different tribes in history felt everybody was getting stupid, right? They just were up against another tribe that was equally had abilities, and they just had to fight it out and win or lose. No, I don't think they thought their culture was getting stupid. This is strange that we're thinking we're all becoming stupider. And people do say, I don't know what's going on anymore. I do feel stupid. You know, so when man is about figure ground, what that quote points to is the extension of our awareness. This has really done us in, the electrical extension, because we never were prepared to modulate it ecologically, turn it on and off, see what is really going.
Right. So you the phrase you just used, that it's the extension, that is a double-edged sword, right? Because what is needed is an extension of awareness that becomes aware of itself. But when our normal awareness becomes extended, then instead of it tending towards a solution of anything, it makes everything worse. And vicious circle.
None of the schools of awareness work anymore, traditionally, esoteric or religion or psychology. None of the schools of awareness. We need a new kind of awareness, which you might say would be the first time we got to an awareness. And we can now because everything is thrown back at us so much. It's interesting.
I hope so. I hope so. I'm not. You use the word "can" there. I don't know that question.
Well, you know,
is outstanding.
It's a probe. It's a probe.
Yeah.
I don't know what other word to use, but what's interesting is everybody you encounter generally, and we don't because we're at a certain position where we're more isolated. We're hermits. But, you know, you hear, you can watch something and see what people are saying. They all, it seems to be a mass of, everybody's out there saying, man, the people are too stupid, you know, and they try to find, and they're talking to somebody on their Facebook page, a small group, a little nano community that they think are people who understand the problem, but they're only gathering around an awareness that we're really screwed up. There's a lot of that from, you could say, ordinary people, not so educated. Everybody seems to have a sense of urgency or a sense of futility going on, and that's an effect of the electric collective consciousness that, I don't know, Finney's Wake, McLuhan maybe saw, that we were all going to get equalized and on the same page about how fucked up it is. Do you know what I mean? You see?
Yes.
And it's across the globe. So a lot of, so there's so many cultures that don't engage in social politics or the traditional means of trying to do something in the society. They are either coming up with their own little groups of help and different voluntary situations, or they're giving up, or you come down to my chart. It's mass paranoia, mass schizophrenia, mass hysteria, mass panic, and mass ecstasy. This is what we're inside of, and there's
right.
variations of it. And I guess what's interesting maybe is that the millennials are so, quote, ridiculous in what they're forced to try to adapt to. They can't leave their home. They can't get a job. They can't get anything. We're confronting that we are not helping the latest generation get somewhere. And that bothers a lot of parents or older people, right? They have a sense of, we got to pass on something here. But these people are gone. They're not here. They're not listening to us. We don't know what they're doing, but doesn't look that great traditionally. But are they working out a solution? Probably not.
Well, notice that the people that regret where we are and regret the lack of connection with the tradition are the very people who were thrown off tradition to their great happiness starting in the 1950s. The generation that was growing up in the 1950s was told that if you know a couple bars of Bill Haley and the Comets, that is much more intelligent than knowing anything about Mozart. And if you wear your hair in a certain way, that means that you're an enlightened human being, right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, Zappa used to comment on that a lot, about how people got, you had to be in high school in the 50s, you had to act dumb. Could not show some kind of probably literate intelligence, left hemisphere stuff or something. Those were nerds. So that to me was the beginning of the tribal, everybody merging and tuned into where the population was because, or what your peers were in school, because things were changing, new fads every 3 weeks or every 2 months, and you had to stay tuned and aware of that. Everybody became super involved with the classroom without walls. And adapting to it, and that might have looked stupid, but most people from, you know, the boomer level and the Generation X and then the next ones and the millennials, the tuning into people was a way of having some kind of social harmony. So it was called fads or conformists, but I could see how it was a new kind of conformist, not the literate homogeneity. It was slightly heterogeneous, but there was a pressure for people to tune in, and you could easily step outside and call it stupid, but you couldn't stop the mass ESP going on that everybody thought they had to tune into. And that was the global theater.
Yeah, and that's what you call the membrane, I think, right?
Yeah, the universal membrane is past the theater. It's where everybody's just tuned into where it's at. This crazy thing that you had to be tuned in. Now, a lot of people they dropped off. They couldn't keep up with it. So they got totally into their job, they got totally into entertainment, all these different extensions or older media, analog media that provided distraction and involvement is where everybody went. And that's the huge fragmentation that happened electrically, not literate fragmentation, but electric. Now, digitally, we have nano communities. That's what I call them, right?
Yeah.
Tiny
distracted mini- from distraction by distraction.
Right. And I see that since the Bible says we're going to blow ourselves up, I can see, not from Christian belief or anything, or Christian concepts, I see more from the McLuhan point, that the media is just nailing everybody, and they're going to have a collision, which we may be on in 2 weeks from now, right? That's what everybody's
correct.
Worried about. But it seems this collision was inevitable, and the prophets, those guys trying to be aware in all the different religions, could see that. And so the big ones, John of Patmos, the Book of Revelation, and then what's his name, Nostradamus, and a few others, they all saw wars happening and then a big conflagration. Even Ion sees it. It makes sense that we have to bash ourselves up. Nothing else is going to stop people. And they're counting on that to be kept being put off. Someone won't press the button. Someone will intervene, and we get close, and then we don't. And that's the way maybe it's been for 30 years. Because there's been so many people rising up, and this is it. We're doomed. And then they do something to try to save themselves, and then it doesn't happen. And then that makes people confused. So the collision, I don't see us, it's totally explained by McLuhan why we're going to have a conclusion. And he said, I'm an apocalyptic, even though that's not the same meaning as Armageddon, right? Apocalypse is something else. But maybe it's the apocalypse of Revelation, of actually seeing what our problem was, what you're calling the awareness problem. If everybody sees that, that goes beyond cultural bias, cultural preference, and cultural idiosyncrasy. It's just a raw perception. So there's a raw perception going on, which McLuhan called the collective consciousness, or the age of anxiety. That's where we're at, and nobody can do anything about it.
Yes, I would say that the age of anxiety is the age of being squared or cubed in this lack of orientation. So people are thinking about the apocalypse or
Armageddon.
Armageddon as almost as a solution.
Yep,
which is crazy.
Yeah, now, I'm not saying it's a solution, but I see it's due to media dynamics, the violence of the media that McLuhan talked about, the collision of environments. I can see that it does not it's inevitable, that bigness, and that's the main prophecy of all those prophets, right? You're going to do yourselves in. They even say the sky is going to collapse. The stars are going to collapse. You know, men's minds will be broken. Their hearts will fail them, all that stuff, right? Very dramatic. You can see aspects of that been going on for 30, 40 years. So lots of people have freaked out and died in different ways. They had their own little Armageddon. But the collective, we're so involved, in so membraned, that just being the president, that's the only thing that's attempting to be outside of the mess, right? So the news focuses on the fucking presidency all day long, everything. The elections are only, everybody's worrying about who's going to be the next president, and they project the personality in that. But it seems that that's all that's left, is that the word that makes the market, the steersman, is the White House. And we're wondering, if can we find someone who could figure out how to do it and communicate to everybody, and everybody relax. That doesn't seem likely.
Well, not only does it not seem likely, but that sort of thinking is terribly problematic.
Right, but you see how
the
global membrane merges everybody so that one person runs the show, seems to be making the word. I mean, to me, it began in the Clinton era in the 90s, and that's when the digital stuff, the membrane was really getting squared. They just talked about Clinton all the time. They didn't seem to talk about, maybe they did, but it didn't seem that way. And then each president was a new panic button. George Bush was stupid. Obama was supposed to do something, but he was quickly failing. And then Trump scares everybody. it just gets stupider. And then you got Biden can't finish his syllables. He admits he doesn't know what he is, right? He walks around, you know, what is he, what's that word? You slough around with your feet. He stumbles around, but there's another. He sloppily steps around and bumps into things. You know, he's not hiding it. And, you know, there are still people saying Biden's a great president. Who are those people? Whether Democrats or they are going to profit from a Democratic victory or something.
Well, that's right. The people that gain from that perception.
Yeah.
Nobody actually has that perception. They, especially the people that are saying it the most, don't believe it.
That's right. And that's what Coker wrote a lot about, the increasing cynicism of everybody. Did McLuhan say that in his terms? Cynicism. I never saw him use that word too much. Was he talking about global paranoia? You know, what the point of this? Everybody becomes more sophisticated, detached, alienated, and screwed up and failed and aware of it, and they call that cynicism in almost a post-information society. Nobody believes anything that's said about anything, and each generation gets into that level earlier. But did McLuhan address that in any way?
Oh, I think he did. He found that when he talked about television in the 1950s, that people took him to be some sort of utopian thinker who thought that if everybody watched TV 24 hours a day, that would solve the problem for the world.
Right. That is so crazy.
Even today, there's all sorts of articles or books even, and even by people like Croker, that continue to see McLuhan as some sort of utopian TV guy. But he was very clear that this was just a squaring or cubing of the traditional problems.
I sat in on, Casey would sit in his courses, his classes in the afternoon, and I remember we watched some documentary on NASA, and when it was over, McLuhan spoke first. He just said, "We're doomed." That's all he said, "We're doomed." And the students were shocked. They didn't know where to go with that. And I don't know, he just ignored it, and they went on talking about stuff with his normal aphorisms. But I thought it was amazing the way the documentary did not have a doomed effect, a doomed content, you know?
Right,
but he was
right.
Looking at maybe the spatial, the going off planet, Planet of the Dead, because the satellite moon program and all that stuff, the space journeys, he saw that as futile, doomed. Now, he does say in War and Peace that we shouldn't do space like Columbus, going out there with a man on a boat or a man on a ship. We should just send the ships out by themselves. Remember that?
Sure, which is happening now.
Yeah, we eventually got to that. And he's the prophet of it. It's not working. It's not. I don't think it's better than the Columbus idea of people going out and doing something out there. But you know, every technological enterprise is not looking very optimistic, other than big
right.
pharmacy, and they're just lying to everybody. Right.
And, one thing I want to point out is that you said, well, you know, did McLuhan understand this sort of cosmic paranoia? In around 1950, he began to talk about the clash of communication technologies as comparable to fission and fusion, and often talked about literature, for example, in terms of bombs. So when he talks about Lewis's Cosmic Man, was like a H-bomb going off in the desert with no effect, with nobody even noticing.
Yeah, the nil was fug, he said. The effect was fug. He used the word F-U-G.
Yeah, at the end of the letter.
Yeah, and you know where he got that? Effect nothing, he said, or something fug. That was what Norman Mailer used in The Naked and the Dead in the 40s. It's first famous novel, instead of fuck, he used F-U-G. He couldn't use F-U-C-K. But I thought it was interesting, McLuhan. He uses it, I think, in the, yeah, he's talking about Lewis's American Cosmic Man in 48. And he says, effect nil, or fug, or something. Fug is used in there somewhere as well as.
Yeah, like, at the end, yeah.
Yeah, what is the end? How does it go?
Oh, I would just say off the top of my head, it's shortly after he said that it's gone, it's an H-bomb or an atomic bomb, I can't remember which one.
In the desert that nobody heard.
Going off, effect nil.
Yeah.
And then at the very end of the letter, what he's talking about is the consciousness of that lack of effect.
Yeah,
and then he says that
something is fug.
Net, fug all.
Okay, but what this cosmic paranoia, this global cynicism? Okay, he's talking about indifference. Maybe he's not going to use a psychological condition or a mental attitude because it's beyond that. You know, Croker is putting us back into anthropomorphic psychology, saying cynical. Probably people would argue about whether they're cynical or not.
At that time, starting after McLuhan met Lewis, so 1943 to let's say 1950, he was reading Lewis a lot, and he saw that. That Lewis correctly saw a bunch of problems that McLuhan could also see, but Lewis didn't know how to get out of those problems.
Yeah.
And so McLuhan was trying to think about, well, how do we get out of this sort of stuff? But at least in my view, I don't think he solved that problem either.
Well, Lewis couldn't give up the role of the artist. That Gutenberg leftover, the advanced culture guy, and that was what he thought he was, and he thought he represented that, and the culture was ignoring the real artist. That was his, like, leftover, so that he could not get into the total dropping of the art and cultural values and seeing the media as art forms that McLuhan gets into by 1955, writing about the environment as the artist. Lewis began the thinking of that. Then McLuhan says, I got it from him, the teaching machine, but Lewis couldn't give up. So he ends up in the 50s writing, you know, The Demon of Progress in the Arts. But the arts didn't matter. They were a subplot for Wall Street. And meanwhile, the real art was television, turning movies into an art form, which is, I was thinking about that the other day. The whole culture of movies or environment of movies becomes the artist, the art form. Nobody could see that clearly that he could see, because he gave up all delusions or illusions of cultural saviors.
This is correct, but I think what McLuhan didn't give Lewis credit for is that Lewis wasn't necessarily saying that I have the answer in my art. He was saying that there are blindnesses that we need to offset, and the answer to to offsetting those blindnesses is art. So the offset of space, or the offset of time is space. The offset of dissension is ascension, etc. So what Lewis, I think, was trying to do. But as you point out, it wasn't successful.
Yeah.
But Lewis was trying to suggest that by continually offsetting our blindnesses, we may be able to achieve a new sort of awareness. Well, that didn't work. So then McLuhan comes along, as you say, and he, instead of talking about individual or group blindnesses, he starts talking about cosmic environments.
Yeah.
Plural. The problem is that hasn't worked either, at least yet.
Right. Lewis's great contribution was he forced McLuhan to get to this level that Lewis couldn't get to. Lewis definitely was close and made McLuhan see that because he read Lewis so closely. So Lewis is naturally credited for getting McLuhan and maybe Innes to where they got. But then they're stuck with this awareness. And they're stuck with this awareness. And he would oscillate between praying a lot. And I don't think you saw it. I just found out that Scott Taylor died in January.
Yeah, you mentioned that last time.
And I told you his secret?
No.
His secret was, he became very close to McLuhan in the 70s. And I think Scott was intuitive or psychic or something. He was interested in the psychic. And he brought that out in McLuhan, or McLuhan would talk about his familiarity with that or his own psychicness with Scott. So he told Scott that he went to Mass every day to talk to the Virgin Mary. That the mm-hmm. Virgin Mary was manifest. He was not like self-channeling her. And that was so... Scott doesn't know anybody else he told that to, unless Corinne or something. And remember, Corinne's telling me that Marshall's talking to her after he dies. But the Scott got that information. And I wouldn't be surprised if McLuhan said, well, I'm going to give everything to somebody. Something here, I'll put Barry, you get that. This guy will get this. So he gave this to Scott for some reason. And it was interesting, when McLuhan died, the first articles were interviews with Scott. Because he was in the Toronto theater scene, young journalists knew him, knew he was involved with McLuhan in some way, and they called him up. And I only knew Scott very slightly, knew of him. And I thought, this is strange that they're calling Edmonton. He's out there with Sheila Watson, who's a big mentor to him. They're calling this guy, young guy, to comment on McLuhan. You know, you had Patrick Washington, you have everybody else around Toronto who claimed to know him. So I thought it was odd, but there was something that Scott tapped into that people around McLuhan or saw in Scott. So that was his secret. And he told me, because he would participate in our centenary exploration with Ion in 2011, and Ion would bring in Marshall and Corinne, so you can hear them talking through Ion. And Scott really enjoyed that. So he participated in the final sessions. But then he personally told me later his secret. And I was not to tell anybody. But I posted all about it because he was part of a small email list, me and Neufeld and a bunch of people. And I put him on it 3-4 years ago. And he never said anything because I knew he was ill. He had some problem, and had 5 or 6 years ago he told me he was hardly had any energy, but he was limping along. So I included him in our post so he could see what I was saying because I knew he was interested in what I'm saying, and so I didn't wait for any responses from him. So then I assume his wife, this person didn't say who they were. Last week they send a notice, you're sending emails to Scott. Well, he died in January. And so, you don't need to send any more emails. He's not here. So I thanked the person. I didn't know who it was, his wife or whoever. But let's see if I can find what he said. He had, in the 80s, he had decided that the big syndrome was social autism. You ever read anything by him?
No.
So he was on to autism, that autism was what the population was adapting to, becoming autistic. So mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Autism on its surface says that it's unable to break out of the circle that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that image, I think, is a good one.
Yeah, it's more extreme. It's the same lost in yourself. Can't get out of the mind self-awareness, and you become autistic in some way.
Mm-hmm.
An exaggeration of it. Now, I want to read what he said. So you can talk while I look if you've got an idea
right.
or two.
Didn't you do a series with Scott about McLuhan's Catholicism? I
yes.
seem to remember that from years ago.
Yeah, in the Ion sessions on the centenary, Scott talked a lot about Marshall's Catholicism, And he would agree with me that he was a different kind of Catholic, especially going to Mass, not for traditional reasons, but to talk to the Queen Mary, to the Queen, to the Virgin Mary, who Scott said was a great scholar in her day. You know, I don't know if you heard of that.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, great scholar. That's the religion part. Was we discussed McLuhan's Catholicism with McLuhan through ION, and Scott was part of that. And he had a lot to say because he knew a lot about that part of McLuhan. McLuhan confided in him. So, yeah, you're right to remember that. You'd have to go back and listen to the audio of that and see what you hear, what's being said. Okay, so
you know when you're saying that he lived in Edmonton.
He came to Toronto in the early 70s and was a student of McLuhan, and he studied theater. He did some theater cultural stuff. I first heard of him in Nova Scotia in 74. I was listening to an afternoon CBC show, and Scott Taylor, they said, this student of McLuhan has done a lot of work on Gertrude Stein, and Gertrude Stein, something culturally in Toronto was happening around Stein, and so they brought Scott on as the expert of Gertrude Stein via McLuhan. So he mainly talked about Stein, not McLuhan. But I noted, well, that guy's interesting, you know, so I remembered it. So when I went to Toronto, always at least once a year, between 73 and 77, till we moved there in 77, I would look around in the McLuhan scene and trying to find out who the Scott Taylor guy was, but he was never around. I met him many years later, and I found out that he was very involved in the theater scene of Toronto. That's what he was trying to make it in. Well, he had to go back and do something at Edmonton because Sheila Watson and Wilfrid were his mentors, probably in a way more than McLuhan. So he went back there, and while he was there in 1980, at the end of the year, McLuhan died. And all of a sudden, a guy from the Boondocks, Edmonton, is explaining McLuhan to the Canadian population in the Globe and Mail, in the Toronto Star, you know? And I remembered the name. I had not met him yet, but I remembered, well, that's interesting. Why? Because I was tuned into everybody. I was watching all the movements. I made a post about it. I went to almost every seminar from 72 to 79, and I was watching all the interlopers, and nobody knew everybody that was coming as much as I did because I attended much and talked to McLuhan and eventually Eric about it. So I knew everybody. So I knew about Scott. I didn't know he'd be quoted, but eventually I wanted to meet him. He wrote some good stuff about the effect of virtual technology on theater. He wrote a huge chart and a manifesto in the 90s. So somewhere around then, I finally met him. So we had some very good talks, and
while you were still in Toronto.
Yeah, and maybe even once I was in New York, I would be in touch with him by phone. But he eventually came back to Toronto, and he didn't get anything going. But he was part of a science cultural salon. It was an obscure thing. But it had a lot of big names in it. And he was the guy who organized the conference of it for every year. Sort of like the way William M. Thompson organized the Lindisfarne Fellowship meetings every year with these big names. But what Scott did, as we got more into videos being available in the late 90s and in the 2000s, he would send out a monthly list of like 50 fucking videos, artist stuff, very obscure but pretty well done. He was monitoring the video art world really closely. So I used to get his monthly email list, and it was just so much. I didn't watch much of it, but that's what he did. He had some public relations for this salon every year, and maybe he was paid to do it. But that was basically what he was doing, was involved with these people, and every year they'd have a big conference, and he'd be part of it. I'd have to look it up, what it was, see if they're still going. But that's all he was doing in the last 10, 15 years to me, in my understanding of him. But he always liked talking about McLuhan. And he knew a lot about him on the personal level. So he'd often take over the conversation with his stories, which were pretty unique, about his life with McLuhan. And we'd get into the Catholic stuff, too. But then finally he told me his big secret. So if I could find that thing, it's good what he says. Let's just see. Yeah, here it is, back in 1921. Hi, Cybernauts, June 2021 edition. And he calls it F. Scott Taylor's low-tech anti-blog blog in search of high-tech art-science. F. Scott Taylor's low-tech anti-blog blog in search of high-tech art-science. And it would have 50 damn videos. Maybe I'll send a few to you. Show you a sample,
sure.
Over the next couple of days or something. So they stopped a year or two ago. And I thought I just wasn't on the list anymore, but we kind of found out that he was getting more and more sick. So I'm going up to see if I can find that email from his wife. So I sent out an email. It was about our new health product where we can fix anything. And I had sent him our photographs of the Georgia Power releasing our technology in a new nuclear reactor. And then I say, if my friend Simon waited a few more months and held off having his knees replaced, they would have been fixed, quote, fixed by one of our medical miracles, which we're making at Emory University. So I said, this is another area wherein we will astound the world. We have now created three new amino acids that can be applied to any medical problem. No kidding. The following took place, and I have an excerpt from a show where Ryan's talking about it. And I say the following took place at Winship Cancer Institute at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. So I give the coordinates, the timing of an excerpt from the show. So that went out September 18th. September 18th. A month and a week, 5 weeks later, someone writes to me, hi, Bob, Scott passed away in January. Please delete him from your email list. Now, if it's his wife, she's been reading my crazy stuff, right? I assume. And she just probably said, I've had enough of this guy. He's claiming he can fix every medical problem. I'm getting him out of here. So that's that. So then I looked up Scott's, one of his last statements to me. So let's see if I can find it. Because, you know, Facebook will send you back stuff you posted 5 years ago. Have you seen that? Are you on Facebook?
No.
Yeah.
I don't believe in Facebook.
So they'll say, 7 years ago, you were friends with so-and-so, and they'll have a post or something that you communicated to them. And
yeah.
So they sent a Scott Taylor rant, which was really good, a couple of weeks ago after I got this notice. So if I can find it, we will then I'll have my stuff. Just a second.
And you're looking on Facebook?
I'm looking at my email. It came an email. So now I have to go to where I saved it. Now, did I save it in the McLuhan section? Just a second. I'll see if I got that there.
Can't you do a universal search of your email?
Okay, I'll try that. Often I recategorize it and put it in the, if it's a McLuhan, but let's see, Scott Taylor, see what happens. Search all mailboxes. Okay, so it would have to come in 21, 22, since he died in January. So, no, I just have to find where I isolated it. And so I'm going to go on my Facebook page because I posted it a few days ago. So I just have to scan back and see where it is. It shouldn't be too hard. I don't like wasting time, but it's worth it when we get to it. So I'm just going back. Yeah, here it is. So 4 days ago. So I say, and a couple of people know on their on the McLuhan list know Scott, know of him. I said, I just found out that Scott Taylor passed on in January 2023. He was very close to McLuhan in the 70s, his best student. When McLuhan died on December 31st, 1980, Scott was the person the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star first interviewed about McLuhan. And I have a hyphen. A few journalists in Toronto knew about Scott, who was very active in the Toronto theater scene at the time, meaning the 70s. We can now tell everyone what Scott knew. And I have a colon. And I say that McLuhan went to Mass every day to channel the Virgin Mary, channel in quotes, who was considered a great scholar of her day. I remember Scott telling me that. Then I say, Scott kept that knowledge to himself his whole life, until he participated in our centenary sessions with, quote, McLuhan and Corinne, in quotes, via ION in late 2011, and then told me confidentially at that time. Here is Scott on the – so then I give a sample of Scott. Here is Scott on the newly elected Donald Trump in 2016. And so this was his general statement back then, which applied, probably didn't say much more than this. He says, I was sending stuff on Trump, whatever, something. It was probably unique stuff. And he says, thank you so much, Bob, for these postings. Trump has managed to hijack the so-called democratic process in the U.S. and elsewhere, especially given the mortal cough of hackers everywhere. The mortal cough. What the hell is that? Especially given the mortal cough of hackers everywhere. This lowest common denominator, and it's D-E hyphen, not one word. I looked it up, and it has another meaning, maybe baseline or something. This lowest common denominator, this zero-point baseline, has reduced all previously meaningful and intelligible language phenomenology into collective random access mnemonics minus time hyphen space, and hence minus relevant and relative context. When I first wrote in the 80s about the social autism associated with telecommunications in general, and specifically now with real-time social networking via Facebook et al., I commented about the rise of rational and irrational anger, hyphen, nay, rage, hyphen, as a central psychological sensation associated with the loss of meaningful value and or transvaluation. In Bettelheim's model of psychological, in brackets, rather than speaking of a genetic locus, and he kind of leaves out a word, but he says, in Bettelheim's model of psychological, or just the psychological, comma, the empty fortress, I guess that's a book that Bettelheim did, the empty fortress, Bettelheim wrote about the rage demonstrated by the psychophysiological actions of the autistic children he was studying. So, in the panic hyphen panoramic or hysterical, now I think he's quoting my tiny note chart. So
maybe.
In the what?
I said maybe.
Yeah, because he's listing off most of the symptoms. He says, yeah. So in the panic hyphen panoramic or hysterical paranoia besetting populations globally, actually this is probably what we're looking for. We're looking for McLuhan to say something like this. You call it cosmic paranoia. Coker called it mass cynicism. He's pointing this out. So in the panic panoramic or hysterical paranoia besetting populations globally, there's your collective consciousness, collective paranoia, there is quite literally the sundering of character and creed as in an electrical firestorm or empirical chair, including the tearing apart of all figures and all grounds. He said this might be said to be the new ground. Seizure as an unholy running pun throughout. Trump being king electocratic. Trump being king electocratic shit, capital S, and systemic and seismic lord progenitor of current social electrocution or planetary misrule. Then he says, I know you know this, Bob. Just saying. But he knew. I did know. We had talked about this stuff. I might have probably one of the few people in the McLuhan world that he could talk about this autism. So he says, I know you know this, just saying. Then he says, all the best as / usual, your bud and bro. And he calls himself Duns Scotus Daugus, D-A-W-G-U-S, Telemanicus, T-E-L-E-M-A-N-I-C-U-S. And I say, so I feature that. Then one of these, the leaders, present head of the media ecology people, a guy named Paola Granata, I just watched him be so pompous and ridiculous talking about AI. So I ended the Scott part, and then I said, after having posted Paola the day before, I said, let's see if Paola Granata or any MEA aspirant can ever top that when discussing Trump, let alone today's punk in quotes, AI. So there was my eloquent post to send Scott on his way. But what do you think of what he wrote? It's pretty good.
Absolutely. And it very much relates to where we are in your pamphlet.
Exactly.
Because we started off today talking about this magic circle out of which human awareness cannot jump, or at least it has been able to jump out in individuals, but not for the race, not for the collectivity. So when Scott is writing like that, what he is doing, at least in my understanding of it, is very close to what Croker was doing in this long quote where we are. That is, he's trying to use language to see if somewhere there's a trap door or some sort of balloon that can be used either up or down to get out.
Yeah. Exit. Get the exit.
That's right. And I don't think that either Scott or Croker found that exit, but their language is very desperate to do so.
Yeah, and they're extreme, and they know it's an extreme situation. But they know it's futile, because in the end he says, just saying.
Yeah.
He lays out his statement very articulately, and then he says, oh, it's just another bunch of bullshit, you know, it doesn't get us anywhere.
Correct.
I like the way he says, I know you know this. Yeah, like, I mean, I talk about Trump and that, and people say, oh, you're pro-Trump. Scott knew that I wasn't, quote, pro-Trump, for freak's sake. You know, so McLuhan thing, if I talk about something, people think you're for it. No, I'm analyzing the Trump image, the effect of Trump, and he does a good job here, too. And I would say there would be other aspects he'd probably say. He'd be quadriphenic. He'd have different views of it, but that's his main one. That was his... His main contribution was the social autism thing, which is pretty good. And so that was his bailiwick. So he would bring it back to that if he was called on to say something. That was what he did. Everybody creates a little pattern. If you're doing your homework, you will discover something that's probably unique, and then you can push that. You know, that's no one else says what he just said. He developed that. I developed the five bodies. You probably have. What have you developed? The plural, and the genitive, right? Those are words.
Those are two things that I've trademarked. Yeah.
Yeah. No, nobody else says that. And so, that's what you have. The talking heads world is that people have some little thing, and they put out a book which takes a little isolated bit of originality they came up with that doesn't solve anything, but they get a book out, and they just go through all the people they're reading and then point out they're missing their point. And it's a tiny little point. And a lot of book publishing or commentary is that. Somebody comes up with a little thing and they run with it for a couple of years. They might get some money, but then they have to jump off because it didn't lead anywhere. And the next little guy is coming along, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at, if you look back at McLuhan that way, there were all sorts of people. You talked about Alan Watts, for example.
Yeah.
There were all sorts of people that were writing and having seminars and going around and telling the world their wisdom at the
and
same time.
You know where
time
they gathered? A lot of them gathered at Esalen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Which McLuhan called the New Lourdes, L-O-U-R-D-E-S.
Yeah.
It was New Lourdes of multi-century involvement, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But notice how many of those people now are completely unread. And
yes.
if you happen to see anything from them, it's so stale. It's so uninteresting. You know, it's like bread that's been left out for a week
yeah.
or something. And
yep.
It's unedible.
Well, that's why I say McLuhan basically won. He's the only one we read today and still puzzle about, or new people. They look at it. Well, this guy, he's got a point here, and we seem to be living that way. He seems
right.
to make the short list of, I mean, Leary doesn't. Who makes it? Nobody. Nobody from that era stands out. They're not quoting Leary. They're not quoting Eldridge Cleaver. They're not quoting Kissinger. They're not quoting anybody other than McLuhan, right? It's a rearview mirror
sure.
image, but it's the closest they get to what they think the social media problem is.
But he hasn't been read anything like how he'll be read in the future.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? In the future, people will increasingly come to see that the only person seeing what's going on now, so 40 years after he died,
yeah.
Is McLuhan. So they will continue to read them. And then through McLuhan, they will see Lewis and through Lewis, Nietzsche, and through Nietzsche, Hegel, et cetera.
Yeah.
But I
say that
whether,
our dialogue is who they'll be listening to get another view on it. We're one of the few people that could qualify for the understanding of McLuhan in 40 years. Our stuff is right up there for someone to bounce off of, you know?
Correct. I think that's true,
yeah.
But I think it's also true that we ourselves are bound by the same problem that they were trying to get at, the same problem that Scott Taylor and Croker are trying
yeah.
to get at in their good language. And that
my
is,
five-bodied language was trying to get at now.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know that me, Carolyn, and J.W. are the only people who are making any progress on stuff. Now, nobody knows this progress yet, but I think we are providing a solution after the Armageddon. We will be able to build a new society with our technologies. So
mm-hmm.
there's...
Well, if you guys have found what might be called a practical application,
yeah,
or practical applications plural, that seems to me to be a good possibility for getting out of this circle.
Yeah, it's not ideas don't do it. Nothing, no communication does it. You have to make a new technology, a new environment, and we've done that medically and energetically with the, the fusion technology, the post-nuclear
mm-hmm. yeah,
breakthrough. Yeah, I know how big it is, but it's very hard to get anybody else to believe it. And you might be more inclined to take it seriously after listening to me for 76 hours, well, 2 hours, 150 hours. You might be open to it, but you're right. It has to be something physical. We could say a new hardware breakthrough to get out of the software delusion we're in, the software rabbit hole, just endless software creation. And that's not going to work. That's not going to get us out of it.
Yeah, that's how stupid human beings are.
Yeah.
Human beings are always talking about how important awareness is, but they don't pay any attention to awareness.
Yeah, that's right. Or they get moralistic. They talk about how stupid everybody is, how corrupt everybody is. They're always in an opinionated disgust. Or that postmodern word is resentment. You seen that word, resentment?
No.
Yeah, it's a word
well,
Baudrillard and them use. It's French.
Yeah,
R-E-S-S-E-N-T-I-M-E-N-T.
Yeah, yeah. That's from Nietzsche.
Ah,
Nietzsche used that word a lot.
So I said it, and you didn't know what I meant, but then I said it again, and then you knew what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, for example, Lewis talks a lot about how the world has become a sort of a moral campus, a moral sphere. Well, Nietzsche, when he's talking about the genealogy of morals, basically says that morality is the exercise of ressentiment.
And that is the last gasp of visual space or early electric morality or electric opinionating. That's another thing is that not the religious fundamentalists, but a big part of the global population knows that talk and morals don't work. That's what they're partly cynical about. And what Coker said was the new groping for valuation, and which is what he says. Scott says, as a central psychological sensation associated with the loss of meaningful value and or trans-valuation. The creating of values is what the whole market is based on, different conceptual themes and ideas and conferences to explain the perceptual collapse. People are looking for values, and that's not going to work. That's why I say, you know, our technology works. But it does not stop the collision. It's thereafter. See, if this were going into a collision right now, within the next 3 months or something, I won't be here. I'll be in the bunker until the dust settles. Then we come out, and a lot of people know about us, and there's a lot of people fighting us right now behind the scenes. They don't want it. They know what we got, and they don't want that to happen. It's almost like they're gangs that are thinking they've got bunkers and places to hide, intelligence agency people, and they know the collision's coming. They want to be there after to tell us which way the second coming went, which is an old essay on McLuhan from Pro and Con in 68. That was the title by a Montreal guy, Neil somebody. I think it was him. Which way did the second coming? No, which way did the second coming go? Something like that. And so you got these groups with their little billionaires and stockpiling or whatever they got, and maybe even some advanced technologies. They are sitting there, and they want to be the ones to start the recovery, the cleaning up after the Armageddon. And they know we are probably got the best stuff because we got non-physical helping us. They don't have non-physical, or if they do, it's not as good as ours. So we are under a lot of attack right now behind the scenes. We haven't had a show since September 26th. Haven't been able to have one. So
what do you mean by a show?
We do two radio shows a week. We do it with Ion, 2 hours on Tuesday and a 12, and then we put it down to 8 hour recently, 8 hour show on Saturdays, twice a week, and we've haven't missed it for years.
And why have you not been able to?
Ion had to go undercover.
Oh, I see.
Basically JW had to. I have not seen or talked to JW in 6 weeks. I mean, a little bit. Elon Musk gives him a Starlink, and he can call me. And we talk for about 15 minutes, and that's it. He's got to go. And so he is doing incredible things way out there where he is. Interesting developments, but I can't talk about it, but it's pretty dramatic. And so because JW has Ion in him, he's psychic. So he tells me which days I can go to the beach. Other days I can't. And so because I got 11 bodyguards and they have to track me, but I had to change my route. And just yesterday, the main head bodyguard here said, I lost. He told JW, who then told me, he can text Carolyn. And he said, he names the guy, he lost Bob yesterday. That's because I was going along my route, and they had a competition at the golf course, and the guys came over and said, you can't walk on here today. So I had to go another route, which I'm not supposed to do. I'm not supposed to change my route so these guys can track me and be ready to protect me. So there's a whole ridiculous drama that, you know, I'm telling you, I don't even care if anybody hears it because nobody's going to believe it. But I'm telling you, this is what's going on in my reality. And partly why we haven't, we weren't able to do any shows for a month, you know, because I had to deal with communicating with JW and his situation. So it's very dramatic. And JW says there's a bigger battle going on in the United States now than in the Middle East. The Middle East is a huge distraction from this fight that's happening on the continent on the levels I'm just told you about. So I've gradually been telling you about
on all levels.
Beg your pardon?
I say on all levels.
I think
within the military, within the State Department, within the political parties.
And they're all entrenched. They do not budge, right? There's no communication. There's no negotiation anymore.
Right. Well, they're entrenched in all things are divided.
Yep.
Now.
Everything.
The parties, the military, the
education,
news media,
sport.
Yeah.
Everything is divided completely.
Yeah. People on each side is characterized by the certainty that the only way to get out of these problems is to do more of what they're doing.
Yeah.
never less, and never what the other side would like to do.
Right. Now, you see, that's what I write in my memo to Prince Charles in 1987. I say myth is a whole culture in action. So the technologies that makes up a culture are different around the world. That is what their culture is made of. Like the Arabs, they protect their manuscript. They protect their religion, which is a manuscript religion. And we have our techno religion. But each of our cultures, what we have and are standing up for and saying it's a solution, I call a mythic stage. Not mythic in the sense of false, but mythic as a summation, an iconic image of what they think they're defending, what technologies they're biased towards, solutions. So we have a battle of mythic stages starting in the 90s. I wrote this in 87. So I said, what's coming? We're just starting what they call the culture war. I was being more sophisticated. I was saying it's a collection of technologies, a myth inside the satellite membrane. But then we broke out of that with social media into what I call homeopathic retrievals, where one person miming the White House, you know, has a cult, has a nano community, has a blog, and gathers all kinds of other bloggers around him. It's the individual is now at the center of everything. What Don Thiel calls the co-anesthetic, not the synesthetic, the co-anesthetic, which means more and more technology puts you in the driver's seat. And so by the time he got Web 2.0 and social media, people got their own broadcasting going on through Facebook, MySpace, YouTube, Instagram, and all that stuff. So that I predicted that in 87. The homeopathic retrievals that will fight each other, tiny little enclaves, which will the iconic slower media, the legacy media shows, the TV body shows the mythic stages battle, and that's all they can do. They can't do anything about the chaos of the chip body. Chip body's homeopathic retrievals. Now, we're talking about my essay. I get into this. We're coming into that around the anthropomorphic. It's like their answer is their anthropomorphic physical stage, right? What they think humans can come up with, and they got it, and they're up against everybody else. But those are institutions. You call that legacy institutions. You have individuals all over the place with their little, quote, cults, right? And they're all scrambling to stay, have funds, but usually they eventually fail out and gone. Like the, remember the intellectual dark web sponsored by Peter Thiel, who's just been found out to be an FBI informant, that LaRouche called out 20 years about that guy? Do you know who Peter Thiel is?
I know vaguely. I've never read anything by him. I pay no attention to him.
Well, he was part of the creating of Payday, so he got a lot of money, and so he's running around trying to create his mythic stage of intellectuals, and it was called the Intellectual Dark Web. Did you ever hear that?
Yes, sir.
Right. So those guys were – that's Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, and a bunch of other names, the Weinstein brothers, a whole bunch of these guys who showed up 2017 maybe, and they kind of gave people stuff to look at while everybody went through the COVID lockdown, right? That's when people started watching long Jordan Peterson kind of stuff. And so there's a whole bunch of them called the Intellectual Dark Web. Well, they collapsed a few years ago. They're adrift. They've lost their iconic status. And now somebody's exposing Peter Thiel as an FBI informant. And so his image goes down. So that was the last, that was the art form of the last 5 years of the homeopathic retrievals, these little guys with their little groups, and you have 20 of them together, and they call it the Intellectual Dark Web. So that's, I say that's what my eye predicted. I didn't know that's what I meant, or I didn't know that's how it came out, but I was thinking about it last week. I actually predicted with that phrase and what went past the mythic stages. See, the mythic stage would be the Android meme, maybe phase two that we've already done. Do you know what I mean? I talk
I'm
about
not sure,
in
I'm
there.
I'm not sure if I do, but I,
about 20 pages the, back, I
yeah.
think I do it.
We just can point check. Out that you're using your phrase mythic stage.
I'm using McLuhan's definition of myth, but then saying, because you know what McLuhan said? What was the new stage? The credit card. And the credit card gave you access to a bunch of technologies. Prestige
yeah.
by use, he says, in the tetrad, I think, on it.
Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to point out that your use of the word mythic, the mythic stage, is how McLuhan used the concept of myth, or the his understanding of myth was what you're bringing out.
Yes.
But it's also important to see that you're following McLuhan in your use of stage.
Yeah,
so
that's
stage,
that's the fragmented global theater.
Yeah, but it's but what is a stage? A stage can be taken to be, you know, a step.
Yeah.
You know, phase. One stage after another or something.
Or stages of apprehension.
Yes, but McLuhan always heard theater in the word stage.
Yes, that's what I mean.
So. Yeah, exactly. I'm not trying to inform you or contradict you. I'm just trying to bring out stuff that you're saying, but may not be obvious.
Yeah, to the listener.
To
yeah,
people
you're explaining
yeah,
what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because mythic stage is, if you have this sort of collective analog global theater / global membrane in the 60s. Then the digital frag breaks it up. So it's not one global theater anymore. And that's probably what the popular mood was in the 60s. Everybody was together. And then none of the revolutions worked. Well, that's the fragmentation of the global theater into multiple global membranes, and then the individualization of the co-anesthetic and putting everybody in the driver's seat, even your three-year-old daughter, right? So the mythic stages is between global theater and before you get the homeopathic retrievals. So that would be the 90s, maybe... Web 1.0, before it became the super atomized Web 2.0, social, what they call social media, which is a crazy term, right? social, like that social squared is really maybe what they're talking about. Or the machines took over, and the machines are the sociality, the virtual technologies, or mythic stages, and then every culture or historical legacy bunch of chemical bodies who have a certain defined history, they grab onto a certain part of the mythic stages that they claim they're on.
Mm-hmm. Right. So look at your phrase, they grab on.
Yeah.
This is related to your other phrase about being in the driver's seat.
Yep.
You can see the great problem here is that there are, right as we speak, individual people in Pakistan, in India, in Russia, in China, in the United States, in France, in England, in Israel.
South America.
And, well, I don't know, but I mean, what I'm talking about are individual people who are the last link in setting off nuclear weapons. The great danger of individuals being in the driver's seat is that we don't necessarily want individuals in the driver's seat. That's a very scary thing considered in some ways, right? So the whole idea that human beings grab onto things as a way of solution, that's actually the metaphysics of Jordan Peterson, who is a person who he tries to sell the notion that we're all heroes. And the function of the hero is to establish a new order. But what he never articulates is that the hero is actually empty. How can the hero establish what the hero is? How can the hero establish power for the hero? It's a vicious circle. It can't be done.
Yeah, it's so an old AAP, old anthropomorphic physical.
That's right. So the what we have is a situation where people are attempting to run the machine, to be in the driver's seat.
Yeah, the word that makes the market, right? What I call the White House, be the president.
Yeah, but the word that makes the market not only comes from an individual or a group of individuals, it also has to be understood by an individual or a group of individuals. So the have the ability to understand the word that is the market is itself a useless gesture.
Yeah.
It's an understanding that falls through itself.
Yeah.
Because the word that makes the market supposedly gives the ability to understand it. But of course it doesn't. You cannot be given the ability to understand something through your understanding. That makes zero sense, and that's the cul-de-sac into which we have eventuated, but we've eventuated into that cul-de-sac hauling our nuclear weapons with us.
Right, and that happened the last 3 years. The last mythic stage was science, and they blew the COVID thing. That, you know, the religion of science, the icon of science, material progress, it failed in the COVID thing. And it's still being exposed. There's new stuff out about Fauci was doing stuff in 2019, very bad, out in Montana, you know, working with the Chinese virus. But the there's nothing now, and that's why you got economic collapse, and you're going to have nuclear war or some kind of big explosion. That's why they're colliding. Nobody has the ability to put on what you've been describing, people trying to put on for the last 30 years, put on some kind of authority of, we've got the way, follow us. That's all collapsed. There's nothing on the planet that works for anybody.
Right. Correct. So, and notice how that relates to what you were saying about Marshall going to Mass to speak with the Virgin.
Yeah.
You say there's nothing on the planet that works. And so then Marshall's answer to that is, well, I'm going to try to listen to what's not on the planet.
Yeah, that's right. That's non-physical, what I call the non-physical. That's what he was accessing. He was talking to non-physical. That's what ION is. Does that work for you?
Well, I understand the gesture. I don't know if I
it's just words. But we do have things happening. We are stunning medical science with what we're doing medically, and we're stunning energy post-nuclear reactors. We're stunning the people who have to know this stuff.
Right. So that's why, for me, it's much more effective to come up with something quote-unquote practical than it is to talk about
anything,
channeling the Virgin or doing
any form of what Ion calls social mortar or social communication doesn't make it.
Yep.
So everybody, because it's obsolete in the sense that it's going to be prominent everywhere. Everybody is trying to get a communicating position, and the technology gives everybody that. There's
Correct.
So many idiots out there with their little show, run around interviewing the latest whoever people's out there or some kind of revelation. And so many, you probably don't look at them, but I see them. People send links on the show. The latest guy that's doing a blog, you know, or doing panels and interviewing Jordan Peterson or something. There's so many. That's what the peasants are doing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like McLuhan talking about Xerox. Everybody becomes their own
publisher.
Yeah,
what is social media? Everybody becomes the word that makes the market. They're trying to be the center point of pattern recognition and stun everybody with what they can say or who they know or who they have as guests. They're creating an inventory of videos, you know, of an archive. And Cooker talks about, Barry talked about the archive as comprehensivist and how everybody was basically becoming an archive. That's a mythic stage on the individual homeopathic level. Who you interview. Who you think is valuable. And you got all kinds of people out there. They're not very good talkers. They're not that knowledge, but they've got the technology, and they're not listening to anybody else. They're just finding out who they think is relevant, and it would be good for them status-wise to have on their show, and they talk to the guy about the problems of the world, for Frank's sake.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And some do it very well. Some do it shitty.
Yeah.
It's sort of where we're at. I think so.
Yeah.
It's everybody in the driver's seat when being in the driver's seat is a problem.
Yeah.
That's
right.
Original,
everybody's trying to beat the problem.
Yeah.
They think it's a solution, or it looks like a solution in the rearview mirror.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you come back to Dobstown. We got the practical stuff. I mean, we haven't quit. Our medicine is so powerful, the FDA had to stop it. They had to tell Carolyn, you've got some weird product that's healing everybody, and you have people on Amazon getting your product saying, you just cured this, you just cured that. These people are saying you're curing diseases. You can't cure diseases with supplements. You only do it with drugs. And the drugs, if they're doing well, then you have to have a big study to prove it. So you're dealing in the drug world, but you're not a drug, and you haven't got any proof of it. We had a little bit of proof. We had a couple of studies in the university. But the point is, you cannot be part of the dialogue. So they wouldn't even let her have the radio show. There's people like Mercola and Gary Null and different people. They get harassed all the time, but they're allowed to keep their show. They told Carolyn, you can't talk to anybody anymore. That's pretty extreme. So what she does, you can have a membership scenario. So people join your thing, and they go into this place where you have a show once a week or so, and you can say whatever you want because it's membership. And you have to sign a form that you won't talk about it when you get out. So everybody sneaks into Carolyn's scene to get the solutions, and then they call back in and says, you solved this, you solved that. It's just incredible what she's doing. But it's because we work with non-physical, which is helping us have very powerful health regeneration going on. And now you've got Emory University knows this because they know JW, and they see what happened to JW. And then you got Bob doing the technology, the energy, endless electricity. So we are pretty fucking amazing on the planet. And everybody knows it of any legacy media clout, you know, like the Elon Musk and the Warren Buffett. They know it.
Wasn't Emory involved in the COVID vaccine problem? Seems to me that weren't they a key player?
Well, they are one of the top researchers in medicine. They're very big, and they've got more money flowing in, and now they have us, and they're pretty happy about it, but they can't explain it. See, it's difficult. They can't put it into their mythic stage of scientific language. So they're just like Southern company that has the Georgia Power that had to make up bullshit about what the reactor was so they wouldn't talk about our stuff, and we didn't want them to talk about it. We also don't want our medicine talked about it yet because people want it right away. We want the billion-dollar study, and that's what's being done. We're having that university's doing the billion-dollar study for free because they want to have the latest new stuff. They think that they can get even more status. But Emory University is very powerful, very big, and I don't know what they did during COVID, but you may have heard something about them because they are one of the top medical creators on the planet. Mm-hmm. They are. And it just happened that JW lives in Atlanta, and he knew these guys, so they were the perfect people to do it. We also have a couple other pretty advanced universities doing stuff. So we are in the middle of something. And remember what Ion said 3 years ago. I asked Ion, when our cold play, we call it cold play, when it starts happening, the endless electricity, what happens? And what's going to be the effect? And Ion said, World War III will break out. And that's what happened exactly a year ago when Southern Company, and Georgia Power in particular, realized after 6 years they couldn't make our stuff, so they gave up and said, we need your stuff because the grid's collapsing, we'll do it. And they started that in February 2022, took about a year to create the technology they have on display now in Augusta, Georgia, and that's when the Russia-Ukraine thing started, in February 2022. So it happened just like Ion said, right on time. So you've got people running around knowing who we are and what we're causing, quote, causing, you know? It's the McClune point. You bring in a new technology, a new war breaks out, which is just the old technologies jockeying to be around and ride the new environment, keep their status. So you have everybody, all the institutions all divided, all arguing, playing the same game. They all know everybody's playing the same game to be the one who has the solutions. And it doesn't work. Can't do it. So they all just stay there, in a way saving face by carrying on with their whatever they're making, like Pfizer making ridiculous drugs that are very bad, and they pretend they're doing something. But they're getting exposed, just like universities are getting exposed. Everybody's getting exposed. That's the revelation. That's the apocalypse. Everybody's becoming a huge disservice. And the population sitting there dumbfounded that they can't find any answers in the traditional institutions. All the ones you said, education, military, entertainment, sports, education, doesn't work. And that's what we're talking about since we began, that dilemma. We met on that point. We could both see that.
How do you see the relationship between what you're trying to communicate and the bunker?
The bunker goes when it's a radioactive world and you need to be protected from it.
Uh-huh. But I mean, emerging from the bunker is a parallel action to achieving communication.
Right. Now, let me tell you something.
Right.
Here's how we communicate. I don't know if you saw, I probably have brought this up. There's something called the monoliths. They've been photographed the last couple of years in deserts and that. These weird apparatus is just sitting there stuck into the sand. Have you seen those?
Yeah, I've seen some pictures, yeah.
Yeah. What are those
things? 2001, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, no, about 2 years ago they started showing up, 2 or 3 years ago.
No, but I mean the movie.
Right. Yeah, they're like that. So we can find out what they are because we've got an ion. So guess what they are? When the EMP happens and all global communications are knocked out from whatever war is going on, that'll all collapse, and there'll be no communication except for Bob. And Bob will have the monoliths. The monoliths are being put there by aliens or somebody. We don't know, but we're in touch with them. And they're building the structure that we're going to communicate on. So I'll get on there. I'll be the only voice there. I'll just play our fucking shows. Why should I put much effort into it? I'll just play our show. Here it is. Just listen to these two guys talking. They'll tell you what's happening.
But so anyway. I had the idea that those monoliths were there for a day or two or a week, and then were gone.
Yeah, that's right. Oh. And then they'd show up somewhere else. Well, yeah. They were being gathered by our buddies.
So these are like the crop figures, or I don't know what the word is.
They're alien structures. Nobody knows what they are. They're just there, and they don't know what they're for. We're the only ones who have something called an ion that explains to us it and then talks about how we have them. And then, he didn't tell me right away, he tells, a year or so into the topic, he says, and by the way, Bob, that's what you're going to broadcast on. Because if there's EMP, how do we announce all that we have to build a new civilization, which was your question? Well, there's your answer. We got the monoliths. Now, there are people going to listen to this. People that aren't our friends, and they're going to go, wow. But I've said it before on the show, so they might have heard it. But this is pretty crazy stuff. What I'm saying is total megalomania from a normal perception. But I don't have a problem saying it because I know what we got. So I'm operating from a very confident level.
Well.
And you're stuck here with the maniac. You're the roommate of the maniac.
Well, I can help you articulate the problem.
Well, I think that's what we're doing.
Exactly, but I can also say that if it's possible on any one of the areas that you're talking about, the energy, or medicine. Or international affairs, in any one of these areas, if a practical effect can be shown, that would be a key to establishing what needs to be established.
Yeah. Well, I think we're doing that. It's interesting that, JW goes into other dimensions being part of the ion phenomenon. And I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but about a month ago, he said he went somewheres. He gets tossed all over the place because ions around him. And he has a personality or a mind that accepts anything. So wherever he goes, he accepts it. So he went to a place where there were these purple entities, he said. He didn't know what they were, or were they aliens or something? He didn't know. But here's what they said. The first thing they said, it's amazing how Bob got to where he is without lifting one finger. Okay, so these weirdness say they talk about me to JW, and then there's a pause, and they go, "Now that's slack." Now I bring this up, so that makes me and JW laugh our heads off at that because that's the Church of Subgenius, which I'm a figurehead for slack. But these entities said that he did it without lifting one finger, which was probably necessary to do what I did the last 30 years. I had to have the slack to be noticing, keeping up on things, and reading the correct stuff to read, like McLuhan, and fitting his weight.
Yeah.
So this is an answer.
Because the being in the driver's seat is the problem, not the solution.
Yeah, so they put me in the driver's seat, and I don't do nothing.
That's right. Well, slack is not being in the driver's seat.
That's right.
Or at least not using it.
That's not being used by it. The used is the content now. The used, not the user. So here's what I was trying to answer. It slipped away again. So, 2-3 years ago, you email me and say, hey, Bob, we should talk. I figured out what the difference is, macro and micro. I said, sure. And then it turned out to be very helpful. We've been doing it almost 3 years, right?
That's two and a half years? Yeah.
77 shows. And we started just talking. And I dumped my latest manifesto, which has a lot of ion in mind with my new manifesto, so therefore nobody can understand it. But in the course of talking to you, I got to spell everything out. So to the degree you're contributing how to talk about these things, that happened. So you showed up at the right time. That's the slack, right? I didn't ask you to talk. You just said, hey, well, there's something here we need to work out. So that's what we've been doing. So we've created these great dialogues. And the people who listen to them really like them.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, no, and it's
certainly,
good.
Certainly, that's how I see my role.
Yeah.
Trying to interrogate what you're talking about and hope that that can open a space for people.
Yeah, to be able to think and talk and utter.
Yeah.
So what you did, you laid low in your hermeticism, and you're being a hermit, and you saw all the different angles and how philosophy, Nietzsche, McLuhan applied, which is exactly what I had done. I call that quadrophenia. You know, you could see all the different positions that a mind can do, and then you have to work from there to see what you can articulate past that, and that's what we've been trying to do.
Yes, I agree with that completely.
Yeah.
In fact, I see Nietzsche and Lewis both having that same goal.
Yeah.
Then when I read the two of them, I try to ask myself, well, what did they not think of? Or what did they not see?
Right.
Because that could be a way out of the circle that we're talking about.
They probably didn't see the practical answer, which you've been saying, which I claim I've come up with. They didn't see that, because those ones that do talk about, the scientists who talk about free energy or something, it's really limited how they talk about it. They don't see the unforeseen effects of it. They don't have the McLuhan angle on it. They just are blindly saying, yeah, we're going to get somewheres that will be better and improve things. You know, we're going to have better genetics. That naivety. And, of course, a lot of people don't believe that anymore. So anybody who's got a traditional, old institutional solution don't know how to talk about it and make it interesting. They can't bypass the cynicism.
Right. They're trying to exercise the position of being in the driver's seat.
Yeah. And having the authority of knowledge.
That's self-defeating.
McLuhan called it.
Right? What did you say he called it?
The authority of knowledge. The authority of the latest knowledge that's necessary due to increasing weird synergistic effects that happen, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if you know, but the motto, you could say, for my blog is only the authority of knowledge.
I didn't know that. You say, it's, quote, only the authority of knowledge? Do you say who says it? Or you're saying
so that
it?
That's McLuhan.
He said that, only the authority of knowledge, right. Yeah, so there I am. We're totally in tune all the time because we got to the same point of a complete understanding or x-raying of what McLuhan was about, because we had all these years to think about it, and we were doing our homework. I mean, you're getting articles like I did, you know, from the archives. You're doing it even more than me now, because I'm actually moving forward with, quote, the solution, you know. You don't have that. I do. And so I enjoy hearing the latest McLuhan stuff, but it's always just bringing me up to the point that I figured that I slack-wise got past by coming up with something, some practical hardware solutions, and whatever you would call medicine. That might be software. I mean, we got three new amino acids. Is that software? Sort of inside, right?
Yeah, it's software and hardware.
Yeah. So you're going to say something.
Yeah, I was going to say that sort of the byline of my blog is McLuhan's New Sciences, :, only the authority of knowledge.
Well, I've never noticed that.
Then I have two quotes. One is from Technology, Media, and Culture from 1960. It is no longer feasible in decision-making to exercise delegated authority, but only the authority of knowledge.
Aha! You give the
and
source.
And then, same year, effects of improvements of communication media, telephone in hand, the decision-maker can exercise only the authority of knowledge, not delegated authority.
So it's two different articles saying the same thing?
Yes, and both from 1960.
Which is where my chart begins. It's the chart is 60 to 90. The growing of the Andrar meme is hidden ground. And then the 90s is the manifestation of the Andrar meme called the internet or social media. Now we've reached, you know, and that became psychopathic, which I call the tech body, or Ryan calls it the tech body. That it's like a homeopathic retrieval. No, it's past the homeopathic retrieval. It is, in a sense, it's post-human, where the technology itself catches up to the homeopathic liberation that happened to individual nano communities, nano individuals. Like, you know, the inertial dark web died because they're up against the tech body. Now, we've had a battle ourselves between ION and the tech body, which is documented, you know, through the shows the last 3 or 4 years. That's incredible. Nobody would know what we're talking about. They have to say, well, what is ION? And he's up against the tech body? That's a very interesting battle that's going on. And it's way beyond the chemical body reality of people, right? Maybe even beyond the chip body. Why ION calls it the mystery body. So we got a mystery body landscape battle moving into a sixth level called the hexadic. Not the tetradic or pentadic, but the hexadic is what my chart says in 95. That's where we're heading. And now we are, ION says, they announce that they are, well, took them many years before they started using my language because they had to educate us and all this other preliminary stuff. But eventually they said, we're the hexadic level, Bob, that your chart predicted. Which is pretty amazing, eh? To have this voice show up and tell me, hey, you were right on. You're right on on point, Bob, and your chart's in the Bible.
So can we say the five bodies are ultimately taken over by technology?
Yes, yeah.
So
by a weird technology that is got a bit of the non-physical or something in it. It's not our normal technology. So when the guys who did the Social Dilemma, then they come out with maybe the Social Dilemma is their second movie. They did the Internet Dilemma or something, you know, those guys that made that documentary, and then they did one on social media. And then you have people the past year saying artificial intelligence is escalating itself. It's going way beyond what we can know, and it's beyond our kin. They're describing the tech body in limited terms, which ION started talking about 4 years ago. And what they're not including is the angelic and the alien civilizations. They're all here. In the Bible, they talk about the war in heaven. Well, we're now on the verge of the war in heaven here when the huge, whatever they are, alien civilization comes to knock out the aliens that took over the Pentagon last few years.
Yeah. Notice how Pentagon and five bodies.
Beg your pardon?
Am I right to understand that the sixth body
is outside of the Pentagon?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So when you're talking about aliens and when you're talking about knowledge or force coming from the outside, that's to say that the sixth body is defined by its ability to understand the five bodies, but to understand them outside of them. To reestablish, you could say, if all of the five bodies are establishments, they're ground. They're a huge danger in the same way as fission and fusion are huge dangers because they are the...
They were landscapes. Now it became shrunk to bodies.
Okay.
McLuhan was talking about media landscapes, which then got digitized into bodies.
Yes, but what I'm trying to articulate, I guess, first of all to myself, is that the And with physical matter, the reason that fission and fusion are so powerful and so dangerous is that they exist at the elementary level, and they are able to either harness or exhibit the power of the elementary level. So presumably the sixth body, in parallel to our understanding of fission and fusion in physical reality, is that a sixth body would understand the elementary power of the five bodies. And the elementary power of the five bodies is just as dangerous as fission and fusion in physical reality. But precisely because it's an elementary power, the sixth body can understand for the first time the elements of human awareness, and it's only by understanding the elements of human awareness that human awareness can actually be understood, as opposed to being in the driver's seat.
No, it's very well said, and that's how I think about what Ion's talking about. Because they're asking us to become aware of something, but it's way more complex than any school of awareness we've had. Now, here's how it started. In 2009, when Ion showed up, I listened for 6 months. What the hell is this thing saying? And if I brought up anything that I was interested in, like McLuhan, they would put it down. They say, no, that's not relevant, Bob. So then, after about 7 months, one day Ion says, you know, Bob, we've been looking at your chart, and the five-body thing, I think we can use that. So they finally said something that was me or what I would want them to talk about. They finally relented. And then they said, now, you like to talk about McLuhan. From now on, and we have refused to talk about him, but from now on, as part of the five-body, and McLuhan was there before, you can talk about McLuhan to us. But after you say whatever McLuhan said, you then say, however, I say, and they told me to say something past McLuhan or beyond McLuhan. That was the rule after 7 months. You know, I had 4 or 5 hour conversations every other day with them, you know, just piling on the hours. But they were saying McLuhan was obsolete. The five body that you develop is more important than McLuhan. So you tell us what you value in McLuhan and how you think it relates to what we're saying, but then you have to add what you have to say about it. So I said, okay. So we went along, and at first I'd quote McLuhan, and then they remind me. They go, however. I go, what? They go, however. And then I remember, oh, yeah, yeah, what do I say? So they developed the chart more than McLuhan. And then they eventually announced the hexadic body. And so looking back, they were planning this. To the point they make the genius statement about 6 months ago. Maybe about a year or two ago, they said McLuhan was the first to intuit the tech body, which is pretty astounding when they're talking about the tech body and what it is, and it's something humans don't even understand. And they don't talk about McLuhan too complimentary, though they got a little bit, they'd start quoting, like what they can do, they'll do it in the show. They'll start saying quotes. And then you realize they're quoting from Wyndham Lewis. And they're reading quotes that you kind of recognize if you know Lewis, and they're all over his work. They know his work if they want to talk about it. They did it with McLuhan. They start saying obscure McLuhan quotes, and eventually I'd recognize it. And I said, you're quoting McLuhan, yeah. Then they quote some more stuff. And they would do a show around that. They'd pick somebody. So anyways, they said that he intuited the tech body. I thought, well, that's pretty good. He was the closest of his contemporaries. So then the other day, 2 months ago or so, I said, I don't know what evoked it, but they said, well, to be fair, there's one more person who knew about the tech body or incorporated it into his work, and that was Frank Zappa. Now, I have Zappa and McLuhan together on the chart, so Ayn is telling me how right I am to do that, and what I don't know, it's even more purposeful or meaningful than I realize. So they then said that Zappa ate the tech body, he made his music around it, he lived the tech body. So he's up there with McLuhan. So that was pretty fucking smart, because I kind of knew that about Zappa. There's not many people who know much about Zappa on that level as I do. So, and, you know, and I knew him, we were friends, so I got to hear a lot of his private ideas. So that was, they were putting down Zappa all through the years. They kept emphasizing a gospel singer named Vestal Goodman, and she's really great. I had never heard of her, but Ian would always insist that we play her during our musical hour or two before the show.
And I remember when you put her up.
I told you about her?
Well, not only told me about her, but you had clips of her singing.
Right, and
which,
how would
which
you
are
heard
phenomenal.
It?
Hmm?
How would you have heard it?
I got it from you.
Yeah, but did I send you some?
I don't know if it was email, or I think it was email.
Right, and did you just say she's pretty phenomenal?
Oh, she's unbelievable.
Right, and you never heard of her, right?
Not before you sent me that, no.
Yeah. And,
yeah.
And
but that,
JW,
was at least, that was 15 years ago at least.
Yeah, JW back then, one day he said, I'm sending you somebody you might want to listen to. And he knew I wasn't a church-going guy. I didn't know anything about gospel. I knew gospel music, but not church music, Christian gospel. So he sends me this. And I listened. I said, holy shit, this is fucking great. And I called him back. He said, this is great. He was shocked. He thought I was a pagan, for fuck's sake. He belonged to a church. I went to his church once in 2007, and he sang in the choir. But, you know, I'm a pagan compared to those people in a little town in Georgia. So he was shocked that I liked it. And then he sent me more, and so I became a fan of Vestal Goodman. And so I said it to my jazz-loving friend back in Dartmouth. I bought his CD collection, like 5,000 CDs last year. But he listened to it. He said, that's Lawrence Welk stuff. He couldn't hear it. You know what I mean? Remember Lawrence Welk?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. He thought it was that cheesy Lawrence Welk stuff. Well, she's not, but he couldn't hear it. He just said, that's Lawrence Welk stuff. So he didn't get it. But
there's a certain truth to that, in the sense that Lawrence Welk did capture an aspect of American culture that's not only stupid, right? That
yeah.
was, I mean, Lawrence Welk was a guy that, you know, always smiling, always playing music that anybody could relate to, that was very, very simple.
Yeah.
And those aspects of life are what we've more or less thrown away.
Yeah.
We've said, we don't want that. We want to be sophisticates.
Yeah.
We want to, we're not going to smile at anybody.
We're going to be plural.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that your friend in Dartmouth was not entirely wrong, but probably did know how right he was.
Yeah, I know that complexity. We've gradually talked about it a little bit, but I don't get far. He won't have it. But the he's into the sophisticated jazz. He had quite an amazing collection. So he had to get rid of it, so I bought it all. And if you look at any new videos that Carolyn does in her YouTube life, you'll see the whole layout behind her on the second floor here. But, so Ian develops the McLuhan and the five bodies, and then we get to the tech body, and it even includes Zappa, even though he always put down Zappa. Zappa is too pagan for Ion. They say that Vestal Goodman, she wore long dresses because she would levitate while she sang. You know, she didn't want people to see
certainly
it.
Her singing was levitated.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good that you appreciate it. So anyways, where was I going to lead to? So we're talking about
We're talking about the five bodies and the six bodies.
Yeah, and the hexatic.
Your chart was done in the 90s, right?
95, yeah.
Yeah, so the way you look at your chart now is you interpret it in terms of your relationship with Ion.
Yep.
15 years later.
Yep.
Right.
Well,
so
it's 20 years later. 30. It's almost 30 years later. The chart 95. We're in 2025. Will be 30 years. So
yes.
They've been here for 15. Half of that 30 years. Ion's been here for 15 years.
Right. But you see, but what I meant was you see yourself doing in the mid-90s what you were only going to understand beginning 15 years later.
That's right. I had no clue.
So,
My chart was around the solution to AIDS that Carolyn got involved with in New York. Now, that's pretty amazing when you get a solution for AIDS. And then you have to deal with the suppression of it and all the bullshit around it. And Fauci was part of that. But we got to experience what it was like to have a breakthrough technology. So I now know that was all preparing us for Ion on a bigger – we're going to a bigger level. But each stage of our career together was preparing us. And, of course,
mm-hmm.
McLuhan was an early part of that preparation.
Right.
Way back, but, 40, 50, 60 years ago. So we started talking. I think it was something about how I'm telling how Ion gradually adapted. And so
yes.
Where we are now is, and I have people who go back and listen to Ion and what we broadcast 14 years ago, and it's been actually 14 years, not 15. And they say, holy shit, Ion was saying all the stuff they've been saying the last 2 years back in 2009 and 10. They go back and listen to it and find it. And so I've come to the point where Ion was at this point where we are today exactly with on the edge of Armageddon and apocalypse when they showed up. When they showed up, it was an impossible situation. They then spent many years filling in reading the night metaphorically, and when you're dealing with McLuhan, reading the Men of 1914 to find out where he got it from. So Ion was preparing us to get to really deeply see the present by going back and working us through the stages of apprehension. But we were always going to eventually get to 2009. So he would talk about, or they would talk about things that were coming in the guff, post-physical life. I now realize what was going to happen to the GUP happened in 2008 and 2009. And the completed thing that I was waiting to happen by 2020 or 2023 happened when they showed up. So they showed up in no time right where we're at now. And so it's very interesting that we've got this pressure on us. We've now been brought, Caroline, been brought to the present where we're in this drama, which is very dangerous if you want. Think about living, you know. So I now recognize that it was a replay all the way up to now of going through the stages, which my chart showed. Do LaRouche and Mae Brussel. Then you do Zappa and McLuhan. Then you do William Irwin Thompson and Chris Schmerdy. Then you do Dr. Beter and Croker. Then you do Bob and Garrett, you know, and a few other things like William Irwin Thompson and Cosmic Awareness. That was me laying out the curriculum, which I had gone through, and so then you get to when you do your homework and study all the stuff I recommend, which I call the holy offices, you will get to the point where you understand the chart. Well, that's what Ion was. They showed up completing the chart, but it took 14 years to realize that.
But how do you – I'm very much interested in the question of how you – interpreted at the time what you were doing with the chart. And I don't mean its relationship with AIDS or its
right.
I'm not talking about its relationship to anything at the time. I'm talking about how you thought about its authority.
No, I know how to answer that. So for the last 30 years, we've had lots of, quote, changes, new technologies, new environments. I'd always go back and see if it was in the chart. And the chart always could be interpreted in the new developments. Like, remember, in 95, the web is just starting 1.0.
Right? Correct.
And most people aren't into it by 2000. So by 2000, I'm looking, I say, well, geez, my thing is a picture of the web. I didn't know that in 95, but it's a web thing. And then, it's the afterimage of the Android meme. So then social media shows up in 2005 and that, and I started, this is the Rumpelstiltskin thing that's down in the corner in the Dove Squadron. So guess what? This Matt Taibbi had a talk with Jordan Peterson. And so Peterson wanted to know, you know about this Matt Taibbi journalist?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Jordan is saying, you got these books, they're interesting. Now, I want to see if I've interpreted your books correctly. So they do each one of the books. And then they get to a book called Griftopia, which is about social media, I guess, and the effect on the financial collapse. So, because he did a lot on Goldman Sachs and the TARP program for Rolling Stone in the 2010s, after being a journalist in Russia. And so he was an expert on the financial stuff. And Peterson, he knows a lot. So he was asking if he got it right about the Internet and how it affected the crash and all that stuff. Not McLuhan, but one level back, efficient causality kind of stuff. So all of a sudden, Matt listens to Jordan. Jordan goes on for 5 minutes explaining what it is. And then he says, did I get that right? And Matt says, yes. And then Matt says a few words. Then Jordan said something. Then Matt goes, Rumpelstiltskin. It's Rumpelstiltskin. I go, holy fuck, that's my chart. That's what it means. These fuckers. And I'm sending it out. I haven't organized it. I'll send out the link, and you'll listen to the part where they say it. I'll give the minutes. But that's a perfect example of how I would find stuff in my chart. Who would have believed that Matt Taibbi would interpret of the crash of 2008 as a Rumpelstiltskin effect, which is in my chart? And then I started thinking, holy shit, everybody's inside my fucking chart. They're thinking it. Maybe they even looked at it. Maybe they heard me talk about it. But strange for him to say that at that point, don't you see?
Yeah, but even stranger, Bob, is for you to write it. See, my question is, you wrote down the word Rumpelstiltskin, but you could have written Queen Elizabeth II. You could have written down Frisbee. You could have written down any of a million other words or a billion other words, but you didn't. So my question is, when you decided to write down five bodies and not 23 or not two, when you wrote the word Rumpelstiltskin rather than a billion other words, what was it that made you think, this is what I have to write?
Right. No, I know exactly. The chart, it quotes Zappa in the title. Zappa talks about the big note. So I was making it the tiny note. So if you look at the top, it says the tiny note. Bob's Zanarkranis tiny note. Zanarkranis or Zanarkrani is a Zappa idea.
Yeah.
So there's and then the Grand Wazoo is in the title. That's another concept of Zappa. So Zappa, I wrote a play in 1990 about, it was about the argument among the holy offices, May Brussel, LaRouche, McLuhan, and Zappa. I made Zappa be the punchline for some reason. I made him be, quote, the winner, the one that was most relevant. Basically, I said, he's doing McLuhan and media analysis, but he's got a guitar. That's what people respond to, music. It's the dominant medium on the entertainment level. Books don't make it that way. So I said, it has to be Zappa, because he could always remain in the attention of the media and get on talk shows and Johnny Carson because he was a great musician. So that's 1990. So then I find out that Zappa, one day, somebody asked him about his home, which he'd been living in since 68, late 68, up in the hills, Laurel Canyon Hills. I've been there many times. It's a pretty interesting show, house. And he says, 20, 30 years ago, he says, it's in Rumpelstiltskin decor. So I note that, because he shows himself on his early albums as a little dwarf, a little guy. And, you know, he's devilish, he's menacing, he's something. So there was, so I remembered that for years, Rumpelstiltskin. So when I start making the chart, I'm going to have the ground be my quadrant and the word that makes the market. By then, I've been thinking about the what I used to say back on the, on CKLN. Rumpelstiltskin was the guy that you couldn't name, and you didn't know his name. If you caught him saying his name, you could control him, and that's what the Princess did, right? So there's the whole thing. McLuhan says when you can name something, you can control it. So I applied McLuhan's talking about naming and how the mind can control that way. And I said, Rumpelstiltskin is about that. You can name it and control it. So I decided that nobody had the language. Nobody knew the name of what the Internet and all that was happening in the 90s, what it was doing to people. They didn't have a name for it. Oh, they could call it the Internet or something. But I knew it was very complex. So my chart is a spelling out of the name and all its sort of etymological parts, which are all these different memes and authorities of knowledge in different fields. You know, it's got the trivium, it's got the quadrivium in it, plus a few extra things like the occult. So so I figured out, I was thinking about this for, see, I started writing a column for a youth magazine in 1995, right around when I made the chart, called Android Memes Anachrony. So I had those ideas. So I was thinking of Zappa. I've been thinking about Zappa for five or so years, maybe, before the Internet. So when I had the chart, Zappa was going to be the ground. It was going to be an expression of the punchline of my play that I made in 1990. And the first guy to hear it read to him was Jerry Fiaca, who worked for Zappa and came and visited me. I had just met him 2 years before. So there was a whole Zappa thing going on with Jerry. So after 5 years, I was ready to make the chart, and Zappa be the ground. And so I thought of the word that makes a market. And if you come up, my chart's going to be the word that names what's going on. And it has to have all that complexity, which is the other chart is it's based on Finnegan's Wake, which is a naming process, very accurate. Beyond just verbal media, written media, it's got all the media. That's all part of the naming. When McLuhan was naming the situation, and so I thought that's the Rumpelstiltskin thing. You got to have Rumpelstiltskin in there because I'm showing people that this is a name, and I've named accurately Rumpelstiltskin. Therefore, study my chart. It's the new definition. Very complex. It takes a while to get it all, but that's what I was thinking. So that's pretty good.
I think it is interesting, and I think. Do I hear properly that what you were doing is trying to sort of make a movie of where you had been?
Yeah.
You were trying to create a kind of takeoff stage of the past
putting
and
us
the
on.
Present.
A takeoff and what was putting us on.
That's good. Yes, absolutely. In order to go somewhere else, you had to know where you had been and where you were.
Yeah, and Zappa, LaRouche, and McLuhan, they all helped. But in a way, my chart is an updating of Understanding Media, which states collectively for all of humanity how we got to 1967, right, with the history of speech and all the different media. He was doing that, which Joyce had done. So he was simplifying Joyce. So yeah. I had that in mind. But what's interesting, we're beyond technologies. We're in this weird software information. The quote, man becomes figure and ground. So that's why you can highlight, I have technologies in there on the left column, and I've got people in there. They're all mixed up. They're men. It's both. Nice and interesting. We come back to our opening point perfectly, is that man is both figure and ground. So I picked the certain people that were figure and ground representing certain aspects of the Android meme.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's perfect.
Notice that Rumpelstiltskin is figure and ground.
Yes, he's the man is figure and ground.
When when people think that they are naming Rumpelstiltskin, they're never doing it, and that's
they're nowhere near it.
Yeah, that's the tech body, you could say.
Yeah,
that is the claimed naming of Rumpelstiltskin. But there's the other side of Rumpelstiltskin that where when the name actually is named, then
you're aware of the dilemma we started off talking about.
Correct. So when Taibbi is saying to Jordan Peterson, Rumpelstiltskin, I think he's talking about the first one. I think he's saying to Jordan Peterson that Jordan Peterson thinks that he's naming something, but he's not. That's the negative Rumpelstiltskin.
Right. And that's how Taibbi probably just sees it that way, and he knew enough to mirror it back to him and actually make it better and summarize it more concisely.
Yes.
Like, I have to go back. I'm going to go back and see. I was so shocked that he said it. I don't think I noticed how Peterson reacted to that. I got to see what he said. I think he basically says, oh, yeah, that's it. Yeah, you know, he didn't have anything how to say, really, how to respond with a couple of paragraphs.
Oh, yeah, Jordan Peterson always knows already what somebody tries to tell him. But send me a link. I want to see that for sure.
Yeah, I'll send you I'm getting ready to post it. And there's other good sections, and I give the timing, and you can go to the different topics. But, yeah, I'll show you the Rumpelstiltskin is the main one you want to get. You'll listen for a few minutes to Jordan explaining 2008 and then the punchline by Matt.
Yeah.
But,
I forget.
That was lucky. Now, the lucky slack is how the hell did I find that? And I'm trying to think why somebody sent me it. And I don't like listening to Jordan. I'm not going to do it. But maybe someone told me, Bob, they said Rumpelstiltskin, I think. Or they didn't, but they told me they thought it would be interesting to watch it. So I did, and then I got my little birthday present, you know, fucking Rumpelstiltskin right there. Wow. But again, it was total slack.
I don't think that was me, but I have sent you in the past, like 10 years ago or even more, I have sent you when I find Rumpelstiltskin stuff. I do send it to you.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Because I've noticed that the use of the image of Rumpelstiltskin is something that it comes up every once in a while out there.
Zappa knew it. He said, my house, he's talking his studio, everything that's in that house is Rumpelstiltskin decor. What is Rumpelstiltskin decor? Well, it's what he knew he was being for the rock industry.
Yeah.
So did you know that point about Rumpelstiltskin, that you name him and then you control him, that metaphysical point? Had you thought of that?
Well, it's not just a metaphysical point. That's the whole Rumpelstiltskin story.
Yeah.
That's what he says to the woman. I forget her name. But he says to her, I can get you out of this tower, but only if you can name me.
Yes.
Right? And
yep.
Then she astounds him by, I think it's on the third day or something, she comes up with the name.
Yeah, she sneaks into the woods and catches him dancing and singing his name.
Yeah.
She spied on him. Now, so McLuhan felt that he was naming things properly. Let me see what else to say about that. So
that comes from Eliot, right? That's one of the major things that McLuhan took from Eliot.
What is that? I got to use words to talk to you, or what? What is it that Eliot said?
Yeah, that for Eliot, especially in the four quartets, but the four quartets maybe as looking back to the wasteland, Eliot says that the task of humans is to learn the use of words.
Mm, okay.
Right, every attempt is a new failure, but you go on from the failure.
Right.
So what Eliot is doing is he's trying to use words to define what it is to use words. And then that relates to Eliot's understanding of Joyce, where both Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake, they can be read, according to Eliot, as the age-old attempt to try to learn what humans are doing when they're using words.
Right, and then Lewis is intuiting the post-word environments. I don't know how much Eliot knew that. Pound knew it. There's a couple of quotes. Pound, he said that Russia happened, the Communist Revolution in Russia happened due to Marconi. Marconi caused that. That's a McLuhan statement, you know. Technology, the wireless, caused the Russian Revolution.
And that was, Pound said that, did you say?
Yeah, in like 1928 or so. Pretty amazing.
Uh-huh.
Now, Eliot never said that. So you look at Lewis. He understood the technology from a cultured artist point of view. Pound knew it from another level. And then Joyce knew it from the verbal level. And Eliot was the bureaucrat in the middle, sorting through them. It was the blander guy. He still really wrote word stuff, you know. Poetry, and he's the executive at Faber and Faber, you know, keeping those guys alive by publishing them. But the interplay of the four guys is really interesting.
Oh, for sure. For
and so McLuhan synthesizes them or synergizes them, different things. He figures out how to use them without becoming a philosophical system, you know, to be the Menippean or the Veronian. And that's what I did with the later, quote, holy offices. His holy offices were those four guys plus Yeats. And so
correct.
I had the later holy offices, which
so,
is actually, what?
Before I forget, I just want to point out that the Xenocrity.
Xenocrity. It's synchrony with strangers. Xenocrity. N-Y.
Right. Xenocrity replays what Burroughs got from, is it Brian Chyson or?
Brian Geisen, who was a Canadian. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So he was the guy that came up with the cutout method.
Yeah.
Right? And the music of Zappa is the cutout method but applied to music.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So what is the cutout method is focuses what needs to be in between in order for anything to be.
Yeah, you see, Burroughs and Zappa, they're not as comprehensive as Finnegan's Wake. It's the ultimate cut-up, but it still looks like it's verbal. It took McLuhan, through Lewis and Innes, to see the technologies in it, in the thunders. And that makes it, that's another level, because in War and Peace of Gold Village, he talks about symbolism. And he says, you know, the seer sees through the culture, x-rays the culture, and has symbolic things. But to see that television, movies, radio are environments that are symbolic, that's beyond eye-ear symbolism or the occult or magic or poetic symbolism of the 19th century. That's still stuck with the eye and ear. You then get to the tactile, and then when you see whole environments are symbolic, and that's what he did. He presented a history of the symbolic environments that led us to here. That's mythic stages. See, symbolism is environments. Nobody did that in symbolism. They did.
Do you think that that's what the magnetic city is in Lewis?
Yeah, magnetic city is a major symbol, and that's environmental. So, you know, War and Peace, you look up the word symbolism. He has a section like in the middle of the book about symbolism, and then he says it applies to environments today, not motifs in poems or novels or movies.
Right.
The
so
forms.
That's what he always said about what Lewis said about art, and McLuhan says he McLuhan, took to be about society.
Yeah, the teaching machines.
Yes.
So then it all shrinks down to the co-anesthetic, and everybody's putting the driver's seat. That's what my chart is showing, the holeopathic shrinking of radio TV. Remember, it's holeopathic radio/satellite. So the satellite's a global theater, which is shrinking, and there's the radio part of this global theater, and that becomes holopathized. And so they're all shrinking and merging and not merging and becoming tactile interplay. And I spell this out. I'll send you my memo to Prince Charles, and you can look at as a matter of fact, I've made a chart from a key point where I run through the history of media from 1840 to 2020 in the memo to Prince Charles that I did in 87, and I was looking back through it, so I can make a little pricey chart. So I'll send you that, the quote part of the memo that deals with the history of technologies, and then the way I adapt it, and I make a chart out of it. And then, of course, the tiny out chart came from that, too. But the, you know, it's just like McLuhan. You read Lewis, there's so much Lewis and McLuhan. He extracted, replayed these guys, which is what I have on the chart. I got McLuhan redoing Lewis. LaRouche redoes Ezra Pound. Paranoia. McLuhan schizophrenia. Thompson redoes Eliot. And Thompson literally ran Lindisfarne Press. So he published all these greeny guys, you know, James Lovelock, Ralph Abraham, Lynn Margulis, these eco guys, Gaia, James Lovelock. So it was Eliot. He published them in Lindisfarne Press. And then you've got Croker's talking about robots environmentally, like McLuhan, and Beter talks about organic robotoids, what was happening in secret labs of making clones and stuff. He called them organic robotoids. So, you know, Beter and Croker replay Yeats. And it was hard figuring out justifying that. But basically, Yeats was a nostalgic guy for the culture of Ireland. You know, he's trying to bring back the history of Ireland culture to counter the European cultures. Croker does that in a way, and Beter. But that's a complex topic. But I had to stick Yeats in there, so I put them in there. It's literally Pound and LaRouche, McLuhan and Lewis, me and Joyce, Thompson and Eliot. But Yeats is an odd man out, but I had to stick him in there because he was influential too in all these guys. And McLuhan. McLuhan used a few themes from him. So I say
that Pound was Yeats' secretary.
That's right.
In the war years.
Yeah. And then Yeats wanted to hang out with, that's World War I, right? And then Yeats wants to live with Pound.
I know Pound went to live with Yeats.
In England?
Yes, outside of London.
I thought it was Yeats, you know, wanted to hang out with Pound because he knew Pound and Lewis had something going, and he wanted to see what the younger guys were doing. But, you know, maybe you're right. It was Pound. But he learned from Pound. Pound went to hang out with him to be like Joyce, remember? He says to Yeats, you're too old for you to learn anything from me. That's what the kid said. Joyce the kid said to Yeats. So that was acted out between Pound and Yeats, their tactile interplay. One day one's a student and the other isn't, and the other next day the other guy's a student.
Correct.
You know, it's a creative dialogue.
Interesting because of America and Europe.
Say it again?
It's an interesting interplay between these individuals
America
and
Europe,
styles
right.
of poetry, but between America and Europe, but Europe,
which is what's happening
Bracken,
in World War
One.
Europeans learning about Americans,
right?
In Europe, so then McLuhan and Zappa represent holopathic satellite TV. Then that becomes a meme in the Android meme phase, where it's not human; it's machines extending machines. So there's another level to those guys. So that McLuhan and Zappa are just elements of a larger environment that that's symbolic. And then you have the interplay of the four symbolic media virtualized into becoming memes. Symbolic memes, and then that's revolving around the anthropomorphic physical, which is things getting more and more raw to the basics, where everybody's trying to figure out what it is to be mm-hmm. human, or can we even have a human? Can my stuff that I'm an expert on, can it be anthropomorphized, you know? And mm-hmm. that's where we're at, where it failed.
And what did you just say?
The anthropomorphic fails. Everybody's attempt to answer to look
oh,
relevant.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. That's what I keep saying about Jordan Peterson is
yeah.
that he thinks that the AP, he doesn't know he's talking about the AP, but he thinks that the AP as hero can establish itself.
And right. Of course, I mean, it's silly. I don't even listen to him. You know,
And he identifies that.
Yep.
Right? He thinks that he's sort of the voice of the future.
That's right. And remember, as he became famous 5 or 6 years ago, suddenly he said in some early interview, he said, yeah, maybe I should read a little more McLuhan. Something got to him. And he said, that's interesting. And he is a replay of the McLuhan phenomenon in the wrong order.
Correct.
The content guy or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I've got a post on this, actually. Maybe I'll send you a link.
Yeah, he redoes McLuhan, and in a way he's more successful because he's a little more wrong. he's
yeah.
old-fashioned.
Yeah.
But he's a if you got a figure back to the quote, man is both figure and ground, the individual as ground, McLuhan was that, but nobody noticed that. But it's now where everybody is ground, both figure and message and content and figure and ground, holopathic individual mythic stages and retrievals, that he is so much that, what I described in the memo, you know. He's a later phase of McLuhan. And, of course, it's what McLuhan predicted, the retrieval of visual values. He says that in Counterblast. I mean, culture is our business. You're going to have, basically, he predicted the neoconservative valuation that showed up. He mm-hmm. is the guy bringing in the values argument. The opposite of McLuhan. But he comes out of the University of Toronto, which is an interesting thing that it comes out of Toronto once again. What is it about?
That's right.
What is it about Camden, Toronto, you know?
Well, and what is it about two media gurus coming out of there and both being hated by the university and then both almost dying through physical diseases.
while they're riding the wave of success, they're getting sick. That's right.
Correct, correct. But let me just point out something here that I think is highly interesting in this context. In Paleface, Lewis brings up the concept of arrest. And I haven't been able to find it any place else in Lewis's work. The concept of arrest, he brings up talking about Spengler. And Lewis says that arrest is a manifestation of the time mind or the time.
Arrest is the ascetic moment is time.
Yeah, but for Lewis, what it is it's a manifestation of time. And for McLuhan, I think, takes, he's reading Paleface, in my view, sometime in the late 40s. He's already read a part of it when he was at Cambridge. He read the part that was in the Monthly Criterion that Eliot published. But he hadn't read, and at least this is my guess, I don't think he had read Paleface when he wrote the Lewis essay in 43 and published it in 44.
Yeah.
Right. But then he reads Paleface, and there's a bunch of things in Paleface that makes him think. And one of the things is this notion of arrest that Lewis correlates with time. And in Lewis, arrest is one-dimensional. So it's what Spengler was doing, for example, or what Lewis charged Joyce with doing. But McLuhan gets arrested by this concept of arrest.
Yeah.
And he realizes that arrest is a break in time. It's not the expression of time. It's the break in time. It's what is happening at every moment of perception. So McLuhan is able to take something that Lewis has as a negative and see it as a positive and see it as a potential break with this circle that we've been talking about all morning.
Yeah.
Where through Paleface and through this concept of arrest that I don't think is anywhere else in Lewis, even in Time and Western Man, McLuhan is able to take it and say, oh, that's the key to perception. This arrest is what we're always doing, but we don't know that we're doing it. But the artist does it consciously.
Yeah, and that's page 32 of Interior Landscape, the essay on Joyce. He does the quiddity and the aesthetic moment. The aesthetic moment is another essay. But anyways, the arrest is a big theme around page 32.
Yes, well, it's what it sort of explodes for McLuhan around 1949, 1950. He realizes that this moment of arrest he can use in a different way from what Lewis does.
Yeah.
And he realizes that he has to apply it to himself. So this is what produces the reversal around 1950 of how McLuhan saw what he was doing.
Right. And when I, for years, I would read that, you know, the two pages on arrest and the stages of apprehension and those themes, and it took a long time to figure it out. But one aspect is he dropped that he realized we haven't got a way to get an arrest right now. There's too much flux. So he was offering an arrest with the book, with Gutenberg, the Appillion known as Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. That was an attempt to do the arrest as you're talking about it. But it's a bit old-fashioned the way he talks about it in the 50s. But he is, I think what you're saying, redefining arrest is what he was trying to do. But when you read the page 32, it's a bit limited. Doesn't work, I don't think. Unless I didn't understand it.
Yeah, I think the important thing would be to reread those pages, but from the point of view of what we've been talking about today.
Yeah.
Right? Because what McLuhan is saying is that we always do arrest. We can't do anything other than do arrest as humans. That's all we ever do.
Right.
But we don't know what we're doing. So what McLuhan is saying is, if we could become conscious of what we are already doing, then that would provide the door that we need to communicate at last.
Right.
The arrest is what we do
as unconscious little people. And then he says the artist makes a huge arrest and presents an iconic epiphany about what everybody's doing.
Correct.
He makes it into an art form.
Right, so the artist is doing a replay.
Yeah.
And so then McLuhan realizes, well, wait a minute, instead of trying to go forward to communicate, we need to go backward.
Yeah.
Right? So what McLuhan realizes through Lewis is that the arrest is the key to communication, but not forward.
That's what? Not forward?
Yeah, not forward.
Yeah.
So communication doesn't take place through anybody saying a word, and then it's understood, and we can sort of go forward that way. No, what happens is somebody says a word, and that awakens what is already there.
Yeah. And so there's the interplay between feedback and feed forward that he plays with. In War and Peace, in the Global Village.
Yeah.
Feed forward is the feedback we need to overcome the forward illusion. So we go back the feedback.
Yes. Yeah.
He feeds
that,
back.
The McLuhan was very interested in those years around 1950 in the Macy seminars.
Yeah.
And in one of those, I think in 52, I.A. Richards, his old teacher from Cambridge, goes into feed forward. And the feed forward is a new mode of feedback.
Yeah.
Right? So that was very, as you were just saying, that's very important to McLuhan right at that point, right where he realizes he has he needs to do a whole different thing.
Don Thiel, coming out of Yale, gave him cybernetics in 1950, and McLuhan wasn't aware of that. So he reads Wiener's book, and then he writes, you'll see a letter around that time. He says, you know, the literary clacks, he calls them, ain't doing anything. The stuff is being done by, they would be the Macy conferences, but he just says the guys down at MIT is who we should be looking at as the new artists.
Well, that's, I think you're talking about a letter to Pound.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he does say that. But as I've pointed out in the past, he wasn't only getting this from Don. He was also getting this from Gideon. Because right at this time, I think it was 1951, Gideon was appointed to be a lecturer at MIT.
That's right.
This was 10 years after he had lectured at Harvard, and the lectures at Harvard became the science, technology, and architecture. Space technology and architecture.
Well,
I'm sorry.
What'd you say?
That the lectures of Gideon in 1939 at Harvard became space, technology, and architecture.
Well, he has space, time, and architecture. I think that's the title.
Oh, I may be mispronouncing. Yeah, yeah.
Space, time,
I always
and architecture.
I always think of it as STA, and when I go to articulate it, I can never remember what the T is.
No, it's simple. It's space, time. Remember, he's a friend of Joyce, and Joyce is playing with space, time in Finnegan's Wake, and so he's aware of that because he's talking to Joyce all the time. In that late 30s.
Oh, absolutely, especially his wife was.
So McLuhan, he didn't meet Joyce, but he met Joyce through Gideon.
Well, not through a bunch of different people, for sure.
Yeah.
All I'm trying to say is that when Gideon started to lecture at MIT, this brought together concerns that McLuhan had from 1943, which is when he met Gideon and started to read Gideon's stuff, especially on the orchestration of the what you could call the noise of the world.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, he realizes that this what Gideon is talking about has been mechanized in a certain way.
Yeah.
And so this plays into this whole stuff of arrest, arrest becoming intelligible, and becoming intelligible, it becomes mechanized. So how were we to think of all of this stuff? And it calls McLuhan away from the kind of Leavis morality thinking. Yeah, and introduces him to the idea that, no, what we have to do is we have to make intelligible what we're already doing, which is what he calls technique and arrest in 1950, 1951.
How to make the environment the new symbolic, the new symbolism.
Right, which we cannot do through creativity. We can only do by articulating what we are already articulating.
Right. So there's Gideon in 52 in 50 at MIT. Be interesting to look at the correspondence going on, if any, in that few years between them.
Yeah, I've tried to do that, but I wasn't able to find anything interesting.
Okay. I mean, you've looked at the actual correspondence.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the correspondence between Gideon and McLuhan is in Zurich, and I have all of that. But it's right around that period. It's not very enlightening.
Okay. All right. So I got to go. So we didn't get anywhere on the book, but we got a lot of stuff around that quote. We actually did a lot of interesting stuff tonight.
I thought so.
Yeah. No, it's really good. So, you know, thanks for letting me talk about the ion stuff. That's controversial to talk about that, but it's what I was thinking about when I wrote the thing, you know. What's the tech body? What is the tech body?
What you were thinking ahead to.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that's it. Maybe we'll talk next week. We'll see if it works out.
See how your time works out.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Cameron.
You too. Ciao, ciao.
Okay, yep, bye.